Welcome to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast, where in every episode we explore what is research culture and what should it be. You'll hear thoughts and opinions from a range of contributors to help you change research culture into what you want it to be.
Welcome to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast. My name is Jed Hall and I'm the Head of Research and Development at the University of Leeds. In this episode, I'm exploring aspects of science and research communication, but not in the standard sense of that phrase when we think of famous people like Hannah Fry, Brian Cox, and Alice Roberts. That's because today my guest is someone who runs a YouTube channel that I've been subscribed to since I started researching which sports watch I should buy to help me maintain my fitness as I age. So that was one of the COVID era purchases. His name is Dr. Rob ter Horst, or for those who are also interested in sports watches and other wearables and associated tech, you probably know him as the Quantified Scientist. Now, Rob is a postdoctoral researcher at the Center for Molecular Medicine in Vienna and the Medical University of Vienna. His research interests center on the potential of omics data, genomics, transcriptomics, metabolomics for biological discovery. Now, like me, his starting point on that research path was chemistry. Obviously, I went in a very different way, and he stayed in more of that trajectory. Now, after I started following his channel and kind of digging into his background, because I thought, yeah, you're a postdoc scientist. I wonder how he's fitting all of this in. So various things started coming into my mind. And one of the things was I was really fascinated by the fact he treats himself as an experimental subject. So he describes it as life logging, and he's, N equals one in all of these experiments. And he life logs just about everything to be the best version of himself. The other thing that kind of really struck me is, since we started this podcast, I know how much time I can spend on it if I let myself. So I was wondering how we managed to produce all of this content, juggling all of those demands of a postdoctoral position as well. And then the other thing that I was really interested in was how he sees his career developing with those kind of two different identities going hand in hand over the next few years. So, Rob, thanks for agreeing to chat to me today, and welcome to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I've given people a thumbnail of what you do, but, I've probably made all sorts of, even though I'm a failed chemist, I've probably made all sorts of terrible mispronunciations, and I certainly wouldn't try to describe any of those things. So give people a thumbnail of what your research life is like, and also what your quantified scientist identity is.
Yes, I would split it into three parts, actually. So the first part is my normal research, which is more molecular focus. So we study usually the immune system in large cohorts using different omics data, from single cell RNA-seq to sort of multi-ome RNA and ATAC. So different ways of profiling the molecular structure of a cell and linking that to outcomes or to the quality of model systems or different things, often with a link to the immune system. So that's sort of my postdoc. My PhD was actually relatively similar, but more also rough phenotype based and linking that to the immune system. So also how age, sex, seasonality, and omics influenced immune function. So that's, I would say, my normal work. That is like mostly during the weekdays and a bit during the weekend. But given how much I do, I try to split it a bit into week and weekend. And during my PhD, I actually started tracking myself, first out of interest for what I was interested in, to learn some things. But then I also noticed this was a good science communication tool, because I could still do the data analysis. So my focus is bioinformatics. So I don't do the lab work, but I do the computational work. But usually it's quite hard to explain to my parents first the biology, and then moving on to the data analysis. And usually you just explain the biology. You just explain, hey, I'm studying how seasonality affects the immune system. We measure these things called cytokines, which are signaling molecules. And that's like enough for them. I don't have to go into the models I use or whatever. But I wanted to actually communicate that a little bit. So that's why I started also using that self-tracking data as sort of a tool, either in teaching or in science communication, as a way of showing people what data analysis is, or what graph you could make, what tests you could do without the data being complicated. Because a graph I made was, for instance, my heart rate versus the music I was listening to. So I had my top 10 artists, and you could see which artist I had a higher heart rate for. And then you can also go into explaining causation versus correlation, and all these things were quite interesting. And this became bigger. So now we're talking about this sort of second part. So we had my research, and then the self-tracking for me also became a research project, where together with a few different scientists, we tried to create the biggest model of me. So I get weekly brain MRI since 2018. So I still have to write to the Guinness World Book of Records, because I think I must be the most scanned brain in the world. So we do functional and structural brain MRI every Tuesday morning at 8 or 8:15. Since March or so of 2018, with some dropouts due to COVID. But I think by now it's like 250 scans, maybe 300. I have to actually look up how many I've gotten. And I do every night EEG recordings for my sleep. I used to fill out a lot of questionnaires. This I've reduced a lot because that's super time consuming. Questionnaires were the biggest part, and I've moved that more to the wearables and to automatic tracking in addition. So we're also writing this up as papers, actually, or they're manuscripts now. Hopefully they will become papers. So that's sort of how the research part of the self-tracking became. So that's part two. And part three is the YouTube channel, which came from the research tracking, because I wanted to move more towards wearables. And using that data, I needed to know which wearable was accurate, and I couldn't find any information online that I trusted. But I knew I had my own EEG data and my own polysomnography data and my own heart rate data with a chest strap, so I could compare. And then the pandemic hit, and I always had this idea of starting a YouTube channel, and I was like, okay, let's just see what happens. And during the pandemic, I had just moved to Vienna, which is where I work now, from the Netherlands, so I had a lot of time on my hands because I was alone in a small room. And so I started making YouTube videos, testing these wearables from a more systematic, and I mean, as a catchphrase, I use scientific. How scientific NS1 is always up for debate, but let's say with a scientific view to the data.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I remember when I was doing that research, I came across obviously a number of reviewers online, most of which, when I mention the names, you'll kind of go, yeah. So DC Rainmaker, Desfit, yeah. Chase the Summit, you know, all guys that, and actually all guys, interestingly. When I came across your channel, which was kind of been too long after you started then, because I bought mine in May 2020, so it can't have been too long after you started. I thought, this guy, you know, obviously all the others do a kind of hint at accuracy in terms of heart rate, hint at, they're much better in terms of accuracy at the GPS side of things. Mm-hmm. And kind of just mentioned that they go, it felt about right, the sleep tracking, you know, that,
yes,
that was kind of the level of detail that they were going. And I kind of go, I'm really enjoying the fact that this is a bit, you know, much more complementary and considered in terms of how you were going about it, and much more kind of a scientific method, as you've said.
Yeah, and I think it makes sense to try and do it at least. And I hope in the future to set it up a bit bigger, because there are so many limitations to what I do. It's NS1 on me, sometimes NS2, but like my colleague Raphael volunteers to do the heart rate testing for me as well. So I always cycle different watches to him as well. Like I give him two to test each period, but still it's super limited. So I have some ideas to set up a bigger testing platform where people can submit their data under certain requirements, like there needs to be a heart rate strap and an independent watch, so we can compare the two, where the ECG chest strap is generally the most reliable way of measuring heart rate. So there you can send it out more to the community. for sleep, it's a lot harder. These EEG devices are 2,000, 3,000 euros, so you're not going to have everybody buy it. And even they are not perfect because you need sort of an algorithm that translates that raw EEG data. And people wouldn't, first of all, know how to run this algorithm, the average person, because you need to like use some GitHub repository and install it and run it and customize it a little bit. And I have to also mention here that, of course, even my sleep testing is far from perfect because EEG is not pulse oximetry, which is the gold standard. I would say EEG is sort of the silver standard. And even pulse oximetry, if you give two sleep scientists the same raw data, if you just have light sleep, deep sleep, REM sleep, and awake time, which are the common sleep stages, likely you will get up to a, let's say, 90% agreement over each 30-second interval. Like if you take all 30 seconds, which is what you look at usually overnight, 90% of them would agree between the two, like as sort of a ceiling value. Because there is still some interpretation there that's imperfect.
Sure, yeah. Now, when I was preparing for this interview, I hadn't quite realized that actually your interest in logging actually came from your research life. So I hadn't understood that. So that's absolutely fascinating, because actually when I was preparing, I kind of looked at, just dipped into Wikipedia and kind of what give me a list of scientists who've self-experimented. And there is a long history of it, you know, in terms of Isaac Newton poking himself in the eye to see the effect of pressure on vision. I think he probably decided it hurts, is probably his finding. But interestingly, you know, there were some really extreme examples, like Joseph Barcroft, who shut himself and his dog in a chamber to test the effects of hydrogen cyanide. Poor dog died. I don't think he did. Not immediately, anyway. I think there were some concerns that it might have led to further on in his life, his early demise. And then Werner Forsman, this was another one that kind of fascinated me. He first demonstrated cardiac catheterization by actually inserting the catheter into his own brachial vein and then guiding it into his own heart. And you kind of go, that's just bonkers. Now, your self-experimentation is way less extreme than that. But can you tell us why, you know, what drove you to kind of choose to do this? And, just give us all those motivations about why you started off on that path.
I mean, I think the very first self-tracking was partially also to learn about myself and to maybe improve a little bit. But I think at some point it's scientific interest, because nobody has scanned a brain over a decade, for instance, and I actually would be interested to see what actually changes as you age, but also because we do it every week, we can see if I have a breakup or if I have like a flu or whatever. Probably I'm not in the machine during the flu, but afterwards, like what changes with the brain, or even if I have a bad night of sleep, what changes. And now we can do it consistently to get rid of any confounding factors, because hopefully at least there will be enough bad nights of sleep that don't perfectly correlate with the confounders that we can at least somewhat tell those apart. I think it started as somewhat self-interest and science communication, but then also moved for me because to the extent that I do it is not useful for most people, because you cannot do anything with a current brain MRI. Like, you're not going to change your life based on those results. So partially it's also just now that I did it for so long, it would be a waste not to continue or try to continue for at least a decade, both because then you have enough data to do something with. Like if you end up with, let's say, 300 MRIs in the end, that's, or 400 maybe if we do a decade with some dropouts, that's enough to make conclusions that we can hopefully also translate to hypotheses we can test in a larger group of people. And I think partially in moments, it also almost became part of my identity to be this person who did that, which I don't know if that's healthy or not. But in those moments, I think that was partially why I kept being driven, because that was just what I did. I don't know how else to explain it.
Yeah, sure. I came across a paper while I was preparing by a professor called Ian Kerridge in Australia, and in the paper they looked at the common reasons why people self-experimented, and it was that just insatiable scientific curiosity. So it sounds like there's a little bit underpinning that story that you've just told us.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, the hard thing for me is that I'm not a brain expert, so I always rely on my colleagues to analyze it. So we had some minor results now already, but now the person who's analyzing it is on maternity leave, so I have to wait until she's back to get the final results.
Yes. Now, I used to work at the University of Nottingham, which is where MRI was first demonstrated, and I think I was in one of their first, you know, not quite the first thing that instrument where they demonstrated it, but it was a fairly, you know, it certainly didn't look like the ones you see at the hospital, and you know, with nice plastic and, you know, fairly, and it was, so I'm really, I found it, I suffer a little bit from the claustrophobia. And so I'm very, very envious of you being able to kind of put up with that so regularly in your life, because I hated every minute of it.
I know. I think the main problem is falling asleep sometimes, which is what you don't want for the functional part. So we do baseline structural and functional, but for structural, I can fall asleep. But the functional part, I should stay awake, but if you had a bad night of sleep, that can be hard because you're in there for 40 minutes at a time.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I think I noticed that on one of your, either on your webpage and your website, or in some of the descriptions of your social channels, that you can spend up to kind of 11 hours a week and things like that going through these various tests. And you must also be doing probably even more in terms of actually then creating content from those tests, you know, recording your thoughts about them. And as you said, the accuracy of different pieces of kit that you've been using. And I'm guessing, you know, that's a considerable cost burden as well, having all of this kit that you have to take on board to kind of satisfy this curiosity of yours. So obviously there's been some benefit in terms of, you know, actually your research interest spewing out into this new new YouTube and other platforms. Actually, you've started a podcast recently, and you've got a website that describes all your a lot of your reviews of kits that you've just started as well. So I just wondered, in terms of like the crossover benefits between those two identities.
I mean, they go both ways, I would say. So I've now co-authored a few manuscripts, I would say. One is submitted, we still have to wait, and also some papers where I actually use my self-tracking, either my self-tracking data or because of my expertise, I was contacted by different research groups like sleep labs to help them with the study. So recently we did a big validation study of wearables, and there I actually get papers and citations and everything just from that sort of tracking part. So it crosses over in that way, that it helps my research life to be involved in this wearable community. But of course, it's not as molecular as I'm normally researching. And in terms of time balance, it's hard sometimes. I think what I'm doing now in terms of hours is not sustainable for another decade. It's honestly too much, and I have to figure out a better way of going about it. For the sort of scientific self-tracking, I've reduced the hours, so it's not, that was just like the, that was just for the research part. So questionnaires every morning and evening, blood pressure every morning and evening, reaction speed every morning and evening, a urine test, like all these things I used to do, this I mostly got rid of. I have the MRIs, the sleep EEGs, and wearables, and maybe some minor questionnaires. So maybe by now, just the scientific self-tracking is a few hours per week, like let's say four. The YouTube part, the testing, not counting the sports I have to do, that's probably 30 hours a week or something, or 25. And then, of course, I have my normal job, where I do think, compared to some other postdocs, I don't spend more than 45 hours or so on the job, just because it doesn't fit in the week. Of course, then I don't necessarily count the sleep study as my normal work. So, I mean, it all, to a degree, benefits from each other. And luckily, now I get to make some income from it, so I can hire an editor and this kind of stuff. So that makes life a bit easier. But what ends up happening is, the moment I have an editor, I can just make more videos. Like, that's, I'd still spend roughly the same amount of time. I just have more output now. But my dream is to grow it enough that I can hire more people for more things, so that I can get rid of the tasks that are not as fun, and also create a bigger testing platform where it's even more reliable and even more broadly tested.
Right, that's fascinating. So you do see it as a kind of long-term commitment and potentially becoming a business?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, officially it's registered as a business already, because any income needs to be registered in Austria as a business, basically. So no, for sure. And I have some rules that in terms of how I can generate income, like I don't take sponsorships directly from any brand that I ever review. The most I do is an affiliate link, but that can never influence my testing. So I don't filter the data. If I have an affiliate link for, let's say, the Whoop strap, if the next generation isn't good, the data will show that, and I cannot go around that, and I cannot filter the data. Mm. I always use old data, and I don't know how other reviewers do it, but I can imagine that if there is sort of an incentive to show the best run or the best ride, if you want even the company to send you their products, because if you get them before release, you get 3-4 times the views, which means 3-4 times the money. And I'm not saying anybody does this, but that this incentive is potentially there. And for me, all my code and scripts are just set up to extract all the data, to run the code, and the data is just what it is. Mm. Only the reference data I check if there's any errors in it, to make sure that there's no, like, some nights the EEG electrode goes loose. This data, I could run through it, but you would get nonsense.
Yeah. And you know, just interestingly, thinking about more the cultural aspects of this, I remember when researchers started, you know, I'm old enough to remember a time before social media. So I remember when those sorts of tools started coming in, and kind of researchers started looking in and going, do we engage? Don't we engage? Is it right for us to be there? Is it wrong for us to be there? So there were quite a lot of, I suppose, negative views of it being kind of a time sink and all of those sorts of things. What kind of reactions do you get to that side of your persona from your research colleagues, either internationally, people you meet at conferences, and more locally in your group?
I think on average, the younger side is generally very positive. They know this sort of space, and they're very positive about it. Even many older researchers are quite interested. So I think there's not been a lot of stigma about it, but I do think if I talk with my, what do you call this? The person who was my supervisor during my PhD, there's a name for this in English, I think.
We just call them supervisors. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he, for instance, as a person, is less interested in this, so he would be fine with it, but he would not care as much. Whereas the current director of the Institute, the Center for Molecular Medicine, he's actually very interested in this. So it really depends on the personality of the person still. But generally, the responses of the community have been positive. I think the main negative reactions you get is in YouTube comments, even though the vast majority is positive. There will always be people who say, this is not science, this is not real science because it's NS1. And of course, I'm very open about this. But as a title, I just need to somehow, for a YouTube title, I need to somehow distinguish what I do from what the others do. And I think scientific review sort of at least relatively says what it is compared to the other reviews, even though, of course, it's not perfect. But and it's less perfect than a peer review. It's for sure less perfect than a peer reviewed piece of work. But this is just not feasible to do every week, and also would be too slow to be useful for people. So I think YouTube comments are the main place, or actually GitHub is like, I don't go, or Reddit. I don't go to Reddit anymore, just because people just take everything to the extreme. And I've heard things like, his girlfriend works at Apple. That is what I've heard. I mean, I don't have a girlfriend at the moment, but I've never had a girlfriend who worked at Apple. But just if you're positive about a brand, they assume you have some conflict of interest. If you're negative about a brand, they assume you have some bad intentions. And I just show the data, and people don't necessarily always like it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that's a problem. One of the problems historically in terms of being public is that intentions can be misinterpreted, and all sorts of assumptions can be made that, you know, have no evidence base. So interesting. How do you deal with those negative perceptions? Because I know, you know, some of the channels, the person running that channel says, I don't read the comments. You know, I just ignore them in completely. So if you want to get in touch with me, get in touch by, you know, his email is there if you want to get in touch with him. So what's your, I guess, mechanism, process for kind of handling those?
I mean, the comments in YouTube are generally very positive. Of course, there's a bias there because these are people that want to watch my videos. And also you have sort of a like to dislike ratio. And this is usually like 98%, 99% positive versus 1-3% negative. So it's like, there it is, very biased towards people who want to watch my content. So this is kind of okay. I do, for the last month or so, watch less of the comments, just because it's some, just those few negative ones stand out so much from the positive that it just, it affects your day for maybe 5 or 10 minutes, but that's enough that it's like, that it's almost not worth it. And it's sort of sad that this also means I answer less comments at the moment, just because it's an extra burden that somehow at the moment, because I had a busy month, I couldn't put on top. But in general, I'm not too hurt by it. I think Reddit is just there, all the negative people combine, and they don't know you. They wouldn't say this to your face, but they do say it on Reddit with things that don't, like, your feeling in that moment is, this is not true, I need to respond to this, but I don't. Because they say like untruths. Like, for instance, I remember one comment from a while ago where the person said, he's not a real scientist, look at his LinkedIn. And I'm thinking, what do you see on my LinkedIn that makes me not a real scientist? I have had publications. I have a decent high age index, not that that's in any way perfect, but I mean, there's so much there that shows that I do actual research with output. There are always people who do better. There's always people who do worse, but given where I am, I don't think I'm in the lower end. And then you feel like I should defend myself, but I won't, because it's just not worth it. You're ending it in this sort of spiral. I remember I did this in the beginning in a YouTube comment. There was one lady from some university who was adamant that NS1 research just cannot be good. And I tried to discuss with her. I was very cordial, but there was just so much bile, I don't know how you say this in English, coming from it, that there was no reasoning with this person. And I actually said who she was. I could check her LinkedIn. She's a researcher who seems to have a good position, and I don't understand how a researcher, I always hope in our community that at least we can communicate about facts and be and have our opinions, but be open and nice enough about it that it doesn't result in this very extreme negative, where you can say it in multiple ways and you can also try at least to stand in another person's shoes.
Yeah, I think you're right there. One of my sports interests is cricket, and in cricket we always talk about the spirit of cricket, which is essentially cricket's much nicer than other sports. You know, and I think we sometimes have that same positive bias to academia, that we kind of go, it's nicer than the rest of the world, where actually it is just the rest of the world in a microcosm. Yeah. So you can have those negative people, you know, we've all heard the horrible reviewer two stories, you know, kind of like, this is rubbish, or things much worse than that in comments, and the like. And it does just happen. And, you know, I am just kind of slightly fascinated in terms of how we defend ourselves, in terms of not just whether we engage with it, but whether we, what we do to protect ourselves psychologically from them.
Yeah. And there, I think I don't remember who it was, but one YouTuber once said basically how he tries to use these negative comments is try to take away all the angriness from them and then see, is there still anything in there that's the truth? If somebody says, your camera quality is horrible, it's the worst I've ever seen, and here I'm holding it back for the podcast, the language, then instead of taking all that that negative, you can also say, okay, my camera quality, is it actually bad? Okay, maybe I can improve something. And I think that is ideally what you would do. And if somebody is just being negative for being negative, or they have such a strong opinion that, especially if that opinion cannot be changed by facts, then you can just ignore it. I don't know. The general saying is a strong opinion loosely held, I think, where if you cannot change your opinion based on facts, then what are we doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And you really shouldn't be in research if that's if that's your mindset. Just thinking about the future. So you've sort of hinted at kind of growing the business and maybe kind of employing people and things like that. So what are your hopes for the future in terms of both your academic career and beyond?
Yeah, I'm considering now how to go about it. I think, honestly, what will be very hard for me is to have a full professorship and the YouTube channel if they are not directly connected to each other in some way. Just academia has so much competition that either you need to be a brilliant person, which I don't think I am, or you just need to work very hard we collaborate, but in the end, we compete for grants, for everything. You need to put in 70, 60, 80-hour work weeks regularly, and some people do it always. And doing that for my full scientific job next to a YouTube channel is just infeasible, I think. So either I find some way of getting grants that combines both in a very nice way. But there I need to think very well about both the financial aspect, as in if there's any profit, where does it go to? Can it, like, does it need to be a non-profit? I don't know exactly how this would work. I've looked into it just a little bit. Or I could leave academia. That would be another option. Still try. I would always be involved. There would always be some papers coming out, but not to have it as the main job. And financially, I could do it at the moment based on the YouTube income. So there is that option, but it's a very unstable income. Like, it could drop. But then again, I could also be fired. You never know. Like, life is an uncertain thing. I think taking no risks is also a risk. I hope I can combine it somehow. I just think for me, it will be very hard to be full professor if it isn't a direct connection. Like, if the research part doesn't involve wearables to a large degree, and even then it will be hard. So that's more of a personal philosophical thing that I'm trying to figure out, is how many hours am I willing to keep putting into both these things? And because at the moment, what I'm doing now is just not sustainable in the long run.
Yeah. I mean, quite a number of scientists going through a more traditional kind of commercialization from their research findings often find that they're juggling almost too many things, and it can work, and they're, you know, to some extent they're probably more in that realm where they are interlinked because the commercialization has come from a past finding, and their research trajectory can keep pushing the frontier of the company forward in terms of what it's products, if that's what it's producing, can do. But you know, I've known people who kind of go, no, I'm just going 100% into the company, or no, I'm going to sell and go 100% back into academia, because you know that's either of those choices is right, whichever is right for the person. So a colleague of mine from the University of Sheffield is just left Sheffield, and he's just started his own podcast called Under Review. So I'm going to slightly steal his idea here. So what would you, out of the, you know, to help you make that kind of life where you're able to do both work, what would you bin from academia?
What would I get rid of in terms of how academia works?
Yeah.
I think a lot of the extra things that come with being in academia, especially if you become professor, like a higher level in the academic world, means there's a lot of these extra obligations that cost a lot of time, which are essential to science, but somehow unpaid. And that I don't have the solution there, because many smarter people have thought about this, but just being on review committees, reviewing papers, all these kinds of things, I see how much time they take. And you sort of almost need to do them to build your network. And they are essential for how we have devised this whole scientific system. But they cost so much extra time that takes away from normal research, that I would wish there would be some other way of doing this. And I think it has worked because there's both pressure just generally for you to succeed that way, and we've had many people that were just really invested and really intrinsically motivated to make science as good as possible. But still, it took away from their real personal research, and maybe it helped them a bit by getting new ideas. But if you're reviewing ERC grants, or if you're reviewing a lot of papers for Nature or Science, or also the subjournals, like, it still costs a lot of time. I don't know if the editor always does everything with all the comments you give. It just costs a lot of time, and you're not getting paid for it. And I think there's some initiatives to make reviewing papers paid to a degree, but it doesn't really work that well at the moment. You almost need to have paid full-time reviewers that are really well-read into a field. Mm-hmm. But who wants to do that? Are there people who... Because it almost feels like a step back for some people, probably, from doing your own research. But it would be a valid 9-to-5 job, I think, for people who don't actually want to pursue this academic career. And in addition to all of that, there's things like hosting guests, like visiting research. Like, everything costs time.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, publishing pressure, which does seem to have, you know, over time, you know, the amount of pressure to publish is getting bigger and bigger wherever you look in the world. There isn't a that HE sector is, you know, is working better than that HE sector, that country's HE sector. And I think that, you know, that ends up kind of just spinning the machine faster and faster. Which is generating all those time pressures. Hopefully we'll find an answer at some point down the line, and that you're able to balance those two hopes for the future.
Yeah, and I think for me, if I were to also stay in academia, hopefully if I get a few grants that are fitting, then you can hire hopefully somebody to help you with a lot of the extra stuff, even filling out paperwork all the time. It's still 30 minutes of your day that's just gone that hopefully you can then outsource. So I think that would be the benefit, that if I stay in academia, the grants that you get are sufficient to hire people. Whereas now the YouTube part, I can hire an editor, but this is, let's say I pay him 2,000 euros a month. That's like maybe the average. It's still just a small set. Like, he's not working full time for me. He's just a freelancer. if you compare that to hiring three people full time, that's a different order of magnitude.
Sure is. Yeah, absolutely. Rob, I know you have to dash and get back to your day job of writing code and analyzing data. So thank you so much for your time today to come on the Research Culture Uncovered podcast and for responding to a random approach from one of your subscribers. I really enjoyed our chat, and it's great to find out so much useful information from your channel for me personally. You know, that's been fantastic. So thank you for that. And I'll leave you to say goodbye to the listeners.
Thanks for having me, and I hope the listeners enjoyed.
Thanks for listening to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast. Please subscribe so you never miss out on our brand new episodes. And if you're enjoying the discussions, give us some love by dropping a 5-star rating and written review, as it helps other research culturists find us. And please share with a friend and show them how to subscribe. Thanks for listening, and here's to you and your research culture.